On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It's my great pleasure to welcome back to On the Bookshelf, Mark Myers. He was with us about the same time last year. His book, Anatomy of 55 More Songs, is now new and expanded with 58 songs, but still the oral history of top hits that change rock, pop, and soul. The paperback is from Grove Press, an imprint of Grove Atlantic, distributed by Publishers Group West, and you can go to groveatlantic.com for more, or you can also go to Amazon and buy a copy of the book, which is what my wife did with the first book for Christmas for me last year. So we're delighted to welcome back Mark Myers.
How are you?
I'm good. It's great to talk to you again. I enjoyed when we visited last year. Yeah.
How's Alabama? How's the food? How's the food down there?
Oh, nice, nice. And it's a little chilly now, so it feels just right for Christmas.
Perfect. Yeah, get a little nip going.
Yes, indeed. Last year we talked when the book first came out in hardback. Now we're talking the book is in paperback, but it's new and expanded. You have not just 55 more songs, we have 58 songs. And
I added three gifts. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So I wanted to talk about those three, but I also went back and reread and thought, oh, well, if we have time, I'd like to talk about these too. So
Fleetwood Mac's Go Your Own Way. Lindsey Buckingham spoke with me at length about that song. Lonnie Jordan of War talked about Why Can't We Be Friends? And I spoke with Kevin Rowland on Dexy's Midnight Riders on Come On Eileen.
Tell me, what was the origin of Fleetwood Mac's iconic Go Your Own Way?
Lindsey Buckingham wrote that about his breakup with Stevie Nicks. At this point in time, Fleetwood Mac was a romantic mess. This is 1975. Five members of that band, Christine McVie and John McVie, who are married, they're now divorced. They're separated. Mick Fleetwood was separated from his wife. And now you've got the breakup of Lindsey and Stevie. So you've got five people who are, you know, in dire straits romantically, but they managed to come together and create Rumors, the album. But on Go Your Own Way, Lindsey Buckingham wrote about his heartache and talked to me at length about his heartache, and that's in the book, his feelings on that breakup and how he came to put this song together and what the lyrics mean.
There was a group called War that started out as Eric Burden and War, and then Eric Burden apparently left. And then it was just called War, and their iconic song is Why Can't We Be Friends?
It was sort of a playful plea for unity, that everybody was at each other's throats. Of course, that never happened again in the history of this country where people were at each other's throats, right?
Right.
I think we could use that song again today.
Yeah, but, constantly.
I mean, that was an integrated funk rock band, and they played a lot of clubs, and they came up with original music. And on this particular song, it was a backstage warm-up song for these guys. They sat around in a circle and played this. And the reason they were backstage playing this is because the audiences, wherever they toured, for some reason, had conflicts. Like, different ethnic groups were pushing and pulling in the audience. Even in Asia, you know, you had different groups, you know, arguing over seats and arguing with each other. And what happened is they would be backstage and they started to put lyrics to it. Why can't everybody just be friends? Settle down. You know, it's music. Relax. And then when they got home from that tour, they decided to change the song's name from Let's Be Friends to Why Can't We Be Friends? And, of course, that video had an enormous sense of humor. You can find that on YouTube, which is like groups you think of as hating each other, actually being friendly with each other. So it had this playfulness, but it was a strong, potent message. So much so that NASA beamed it up to the link up between the Soviets and the Americans for the very first time. That united up in space, the two spacecrafts came together, and they pumped it up. NASA pumped that song into the capsule when they were getting together. Kind of funny.
I remember that. Very, very cool. Another group that was a one-hit wonder, Dexy's Midnight Runners, you said that primarily the reason that groups like that ever got a shot at breaking into the American market was because of MTV, which back in those
days
used to play music videos.
MTV starts August 1st, 1981, and they start airing things, and it suddenly becomes very clear to them that they don't have enough stuff to show, that there's not enough videos, and they start begging American record companies because they got all those videos for free from the record companies at the beginning. And the record company said, great, we'll film something next week. You know, we'll get it to you. But they needed stuff, and they needed a lot of it. So they turned to England, and they turned to all the artists over there. And one of those groups in 1982 was Dexys Midnight Runners. And they had Come On, Eileen. And when that song went to video and then hit the charts, it went to, are you ready, number one.
Yes, I remember playing this song when it was brand new and thinking, wow,
and
it's so different.
It starts slow, it gets fast, it slows down, and it's all acoustic. There's no electronics in there, no electric guitars or synthesizers. It's all acoustic instruments. When I asked Kevin Rowland, the group's leader, what was the feeling for that? What was the inspiration, the unusual beat? He said Tom Jones's It's Not Unusual was the sort of the feel for the beat. Bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum. And the passion he was using to sing was coming off of the Four Tops' I Can't Help Myself. So if you combine those two songs together, you get a feel for what Dexys Midnight Runners did with Come On, Eileen.
Very clever. There were a couple of songs that were in the book before, but I didn't ask you about last year. It was Donovan's Sunshine Superman. Everybody assumes that's...
Isn't that a great story?
Yes, yes.
It's a love story. I mean, he falls in love with... Brian Jones survives him after he's dead, and Donovan falls in love with her. And, you know, she moves to the United States, and he's completely smitten. And then he comes back, I guess in the late 60s, comes back to his house in the country, and two women have rented it, and he suddenly sees her coming up the driveway, and they wind up getting married. It's a wonderful love story. It's part of the 58 songs that I've gotten the new paperback.
Yeah.
But it's Donovan gives me the entire story. It's like a confessional.
It's lovely. There's one more that I wanted to ask you about, and that was Hart's Barracuda.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's an early Me Too song, right? Ann Wilson was sexually harassed by a record executive backstage at a concert, and it was really obnoxious. The guy was really obnoxious, and she went up to her hotel room, and she wrote songs, you know, about a jerk who had bothered her. And when the band starts to write songs for their next album, she, you know, comes up with this song. You know, she produces, you know, the lyrics, and everybody starts putting music to it. And, that song... They couldn't quite figure out the right name for the song. They tried Tiger, and they tried Shark, and it all sounded too cartoonish. And, you know, she said, you know, what about Barracuda? And they said, perfect. That's exactly what that guy was.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Because a Barracuda waits and waits and waits, and then becomes deadly, then becomes nasty.
Right.
So, you know, the fact that there's this subterfuge, that there's a sacking, that there's a surprise attack, the Barracuda was the perfect title.
The book is just full of these wonderful stories. One of the weirdest songs I've ever played on the radio is by something called The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, and the song is called Fire. And
Fire.
You're not sure how to take this song. I am the god of hellfire, and what is going on with this guy? And the story is so much, it's not nearly as terrifying as the persona that they did in their stage performance. So I thought that was a great story.
Listeners can actually watch the video, 1968 video on YouTube of The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. The reason I included it here is because it's the start of shock rock. It's the start of theater rock. What happens in the late 60s is that a lot of artists realize that the audience isn't just listening, they're looking. And on stage, if you're just going to stand there, four guys in front of speakers, and just play, well, you know, if you're a great band, that's good. Like, if you like the Beatles or the Stones, that's not a problem. But even Mick Jagger understood early on, you have to move around, right? The Beatles are pretty much standing still.
Right.
They look great, and they're cute as can be, but they're not in motion. And the Stones were through Mick Jagger. But what Arthur Brown decides is that he's going to really make it performance art. And he takes a crown, and he puts, like, some lighter fluid in a little pan on the top of the crown, over his head and sets it on fire as he's singing this song. And, you know, why is that special? Well, it's special because Alice Cooper comes next, Kiss comes next, and a whole bunch of bands. You could say heavy metal starts with Arthur Brown. So Arthur Brown tells me the story of how that song came about, and that song is important because it started a movement.
One of my favorite bands was the Doobie Brothers, and they had a certain sound, and then that sound shifted, but they got even more successful, and that was with the inclusion of a new lead singer, Michael McDonald, and an iconic song that he wrote and performed with the Doobies is What a Fool Believes.
Michael had the melody down, but he couldn't quite come up with lyrics. The lyrics weren't coming together. And in fact, he was putting too many lyrics in, and he couldn't quite follow the story there about what a fool believes. And he finally says, you know, Kenny Loggins is putting out a lot of really good stuff. Let me see if he'll come over, and maybe we can write this thing together and get it finished. And Kenny comes over, and Kenny told me that just as he got to Michael's house, he could hear Michael playing the introduction to it, and before he even answered the door, Kenny said he had the bridge to the song. He knew exactly where that song should be going. And, you know, it's about some guy who thinks he's going to get back with his girlfriend, and they sit down at a table, and the guy's convinced that if he just talks to her, she'll, you know, say, let's get back together, which, of course, never happens in real life.
Right, right.
And you know, that's what happens in this song. It's that a fool will believe what he wants to believe,
yeah,
and could be convinced something will be the way he's playing it out in his head, but the reality is very different.
The group Blondie, which had been very successful doing straight-ahead pop and pop rock, Heart of Glass and so forth, but they did a song that was really kind of different for them, and that's because lead singer Debbie Harry got intrigued with this new style of music that she'd seen on the street, and she wanted to pay homage to it in this song. And that song is Rapture, right?
That's right, and it's the first crossover hit, meaning Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang in 1980 is a hit, but it's really a hit. It's an urban hit. It's not, you know, they sort of borrowed or ripped off Chic's Good Times,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want too much visibility because, you know, Chic was going to come around, and eventually Chic does go asking for their royalties because they use so much of their song in there. But you know, Blondie had spent time in the Bronx with Chris Stein. They were taken up there by artists from the East Village and downtown scene in New York who wanted to show them what was going on with breakdancing and DJs playing lengthy versions of songs and breakdancers doing stuff. And Blondie was very well versed with what was going on with with rappers then. And she, Rapture, get it? Rap, Rapture.
Right.
She goes into the studio, but they need more lyrics. Like, they didn't have the rap part of it yet. She needed to start rapping at some point. And she goes off, the producer says, well, where are the lyrics? And she goes, let me write them. And she and Chris go into the corner, excuse me, and Debbie Harry, you know, in 10 minutes, has what you hear on the record. She goes into the studio, and she delivers the rap part of it. And it's the first crossover rap hit. Again, there are other rap hits, but they weren't crossover hits. They
right.
didn't cross over to the mainstream chart the way Rapture did.
Right. The book is just full of great stories like this. The Al Stewart story, this is the funny thing about this book, is that I've been in radio all 50 years, and so I played all these songs. So I remember them, at ones like that when I thought, I have no idea what he's talking about, but it's sure a cool song.
Yeah, You're the Cat is sort of like early yacht rock, too, right?
Right.
And, you know, it's this chilled-out, laid-back kind of feel. But there were like 10 influences. I can't remember them all. But one of them, the so-called Year of the Cat, his girlfriend at the time was going through a book of Vietnamese astrology, and it was open, and at the top it said Year of the Cat. So, you know, when readers pick this book up, they'll see that there were 10 different influences on this particular song that brought Al Stewart to write Year of the Cat.
It's a great story. And this is a book full of 58 great stories.
And it's one after the next, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Like, yeah, the reader, it's not like the reader's going to open this up and say, you know, I don't know that song, or what is that song all about? I mean, you know, I'm just looking here, like I'll give you like 54 through 58. The Power of Love, Huey Lewis and the News. John Mellencamp's Small Town. Keith Richards' Take It So Hard. Pet Shop Boys, Being Boring. Sheryl Crow, If It Makes You Happy. And again, in each case, the artists themselves are talking to me, and I'm keeping their narrative in their words.
Yes.
So in effect, the reader picks up this book, and it's as if they are sitting down with each artist who created this song, and they're hearing their voice, they're reading their voice, and they can hear their voice in their heads.
Right. It is really a wonderful read, and I'm so tickled that you came out with a new and expanded edition. And I know it's available at bookstores everywhere from Grove
and Amazon.
Press.
You can go click, click, click and buy it right now. And you can buy the first one with Mick Jagger and Joni Mitchell in it. And that's Anatomy of a Song. This
right.
is Anatomy of 55 more songs.
My wife bought me the original last year and for Christmas.
So cool.
After I talked to you, I said, I'd love to get this book. And she bought the first one.
Wasn't that Joni Mitchell story haunting?
Oh, wow. I love to hear about what was going through the minds of when they were writing stuff. And
they're so open. They're so open, and there's so much pain, and there's so much they're confessing. There's so much they're telling me. There's so much that they're opening up about. Each of these are, it's not just, and then I went in, and then I played this guitar, and then this guy came in, and we used this kind of amp. It's a story within a story. Like
yeah.
The Donovan one is about the song, but it's also about his love story, his meeting his wife years, you know, the woman he'd marry years later, and then the time was right for them to get married. So each of these is a story within a story.
Well, the Youngbloods, this is a song that they wrote and were playing, and finally somebody puts it on a record. But they've been working this song forever, and the whole idea was kind of like what War did with Why Can't We Be Friends, a song about
yeah.
let's not be divided.
Correct.
Mark, thank you so much, and please...
No. We put you at the end. We put you at the end there because, you know, I knew you were going to want extra time.
Thank you.
It's not a problem, Dave.
I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, and happy holidays to you and your listeners.
And to you. Thank you, Mark. Great to talk to you again.
You bet. Okay, Dave, take care.
Now, the fun thing is, as I alluded to in the interview a couple of times, that I had the chance to talk to Mark Myers last year about the same time when the original hardback version of this same book came out. It's available now in paperback with three additional songs from added since last year's publishing. And it's from Grove Press. Mike Myers is a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, where he writes about music and the arts, the author of the critically acclaimed books Anatomy of a Song, Why Jazz Happened, and Rock Concert. He posts daily at jazzwax.com. A three-time winner of the Jazz Journalists Association's Award for Jazz Blog of the Year. Now, we still have a copy of last year's interview where he talked about several other books, including Up, Up, and Away, Good Vibrations, Walk On By, Crystal Blue Persuasion, Doctor My Eyes, and Hello, It's Me. We're talking today to Mark Myers, whose new book, Anatomy of 55 More Songs, The Oral History of Top Hits That Change Rock, Pop, and Soul, from Groove Press, which is a follow-up to his 2016 smash bestseller, Anatomy of a Song. He collected 55 oral histories of iconic songs based on his popular Wall Street Journal column.
Great, Dave. How about you?
I am very well. Enjoyed your book very much.
Thank you.
So the criteria for choosing the songs in the book, you had three of them. These are what makes these songs particularly interesting.
For a song to have made my book, it had to have been a great song that people know but haven't heard in a while. It also had to be iconic, meaning it stood the test of time. If I just did songs that happened yesterday, in 10 years from now, we might think they're junk. So I needed to give a little bit of a lapse of about 25 years. So I had to go back at least 25 years to find them and then go back further than that. But these songs also had to be, they had to have changed music history in some way. There had to have been some transformation that happened as a result of them. And in each case in the book, in Anatomy of 55 More Songs, each of these songs played a role in changing the shape and the direction of the genre they were in, and sometimes other genres.
I've got to completely agree with you. For most of the years that you cover, I've been in the radio business, so I had the privilege of playing a lot of these songs, playing them when they were brand new songs, like Roundabout. Wow. So that's really fun to see songs that I recognize, and I remember their impact, and I remember what a difference they made in the lives of listeners from our perspective here in a radio station. A number of songs that are in this list, Grammy Hall of Famers. Not all of them, but quite a few of them, which is significant, I think, too.
To make the Grammy Hall of Fame, that's just an interesting insight because not many get in there, and there's always a reason why they're in there. So for me, to just mention that, if a song did have that achievement, it's good for the reader to know that, because it tells the reader that there were people who know a lot about music who thought this song was an important game changer for the culture. That's why the Grammy Hall of Fame isn't like the Wheel of Fortune, where a wheel is turned and a song is picked. There's a lot of thought that goes into what songs are going in, and someone has to provide a pretty good rationale for why they want it in.
One of the songs that I like the most of all of the list is a song that always seemed, in a way, emblematic of the era of kind of middle part of the 1960s, when there was still a lot of happiness going on. There was a change in it, and that's the Fifth Dimension's Up, Up, and Away. The wonderful thing about your book, too, is you interview not just the composer, in this case Jimmy Webb, but also Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr., who were two of the members of the Fifth Dimension that later broke out and they got married, and they had their own duet, and then it's a great story. So tell us the story of Up, Up, and Away.
I mean, Up, Up, and Away, in short, was a song that Jimmy Webb wrote while he was in community college. And it was just something he was just playing with until he had a radio host in from the West Coast who was a friend of his. He had him in San Bernardino, and he said, "Hey, listen to the song. What do you think?" And the guy said, "Hey, this song would be great for a movie. Balloons. Like, you know how the kids are on the beach with beach movies? I really want to do a movie about a screenplay about kids and ballooning." Now, that sounds absurd to me. I know it sounds absurd to you, but, you know, it's Southern California, so you got to give them a little slack. And long story short, you know, he takes Jimmy out to this hot dog stand near L.A., in San Bernardino, and at the hot dog stand, there's this big balloon with the name of the radio station on it, and he takes Jimmy up in this balloon. The balloon went up like 100 feet. It was tethered, but that was the gag, that if you won a contest for the radio station, if you called in, you got taken up a little bit in the air, and you could see everything around you, and it was so exciting. He takes Jimmy up, and Jimmy's looking up through the balloon, and it looks like stained glass to him. He can't believe how the sun is playing off of it, and he knows what the song is about. He knows what he wants to do with it, and the movie never got made, but that song went to the Fifth Dimension and became a blockbuster hit, as you know.
Another song that's on your list is Tommy James and the Shondells' Crystal Blue Persuasion. I, like probably most people who've ever heard the song, always thought it had something to do with psychedelics. It was the era, after all. But as it turns out...
Isn't that an amazing story?
Yes.
It's the complete opposite. It was actually a biblical reference. It was the Book of Revelations. A kid came up to him after a concert, I think it was down south, and handed him a sheet of paper with a poem and a title on it that said, I think it was Crystal Blue. And no, it was Crystal Persuasion. That's what it said on the top. And you know, Tommy James, you know, looked at it, and the kid, you know, had his glasses on, his white shirt and tie, and he thanked the kid. And the kid really loved Tommy James. There's something about Tommy James. The kid just loved the music. And the kid disappeared, and Tommy took that back to the hotel, and it was a poem that the kid had written on the Book of Revelation. And Tommy and the group set words to it. They used a little influence from Groovin' by the Rascals to create that nice summery beat with a conga playing, that little Latin sound. And Crystal Blue Persuasion is about a reference inside Book of Revelation. You know, it's just amazing.
Another song that's on your list is a song, I have to admit, it's one of the songs that always cheers me up when I hear it on the radio. It's just such a joyful song. Ain't No Mountain High Enough. The Diana Ross version in particular is the one where you interview people that were in the Supremes with her. You interview producers and Valerie Simpson, one of the writers. What makes this song so much of a pivotal song? Is it just the fact that Diana was leaving the Supremes to go off on her own, or what, there was more to it than that?
You know, the mind blower for me, Dave, is that when people heard, most people think the song that Diana Ross sings is different than the one Tammy Terrell and Marvin Gaye sang.
Right.
Ain't No Mountain High Enough. And in fact, it's the exact same song. But they did such an amazing job arranging it, where she's got this monologue, and then there's this buildup, and then there's this, almost this orgasmic crescendo, and she's just singing away. And I mean, the thing runs like 6 minutes, but it's like, it's a masterpiece for Diana Ross. It's her first solo, but it's a great example of how ingenious some of these people are, especially at Motown, where they can take an existing song, a song that has already been out and become a hit, a song everybody knows and is stamped in their head, and turn that into something symphonic and something so big that when you say to yourself, gee, it has the same kind of words as the old ones, but it can't be because it's a completely different song. And it wasn't. It was the same song, but it was really dressed up for for the ball, really. I mean, it's just so glamorized.
There's one of the criteria that you had also was songs that always are misinterpreted, and Crystal Blue Persuasion is one of those. But another one is Jackson Browne's Doctor My Eyes. Oh, I always listen to the lyrics and I know he's talking about, you know, he's disillusioned or he's seeing things in a new way. And so, but it really did have something to do with him going to the optometrist and having an eye issue, didn't it?
Well, that's the beauty, Dave, of asking a stupid question, which I always like. The dumber the question, I find, the more great information that comes out. And what I said to him was, I said, let me ask you, was something wrong with your eyes at the time? And he said, you know, there was. And he talks about how there was buildup on the eye and he couldn't quite solve it with drops and he had to go to the doctor. But as he quickly pointed out, nobody is going to write a song about a visit to the doctor. The doctor... Doctor, my eyes was a metaphor for I can't seem to see things in our society right anymore. Everything seems out of focus. Everything seems crazy. It became a vehicle for a socially conscious statement. But like all interesting things, like all great titles, you know, where did it come from? It came from his eye trouble.
I got time for one more question, and that is about Todd Rundgren's "Hello, It's Me." I discovered from your book that two of my favorite jazz rockers, Michael Brecker and his brother Randy, who were in the original album of Blood, Sweat, and Tears as a saxophone and trumpet player, they're part of the backup. This is an example of a relatively simple song that is beautifully produced, and which is not a surprise because Todd Rundgren's a great record producer, but it's so completely different than the kind of stuff that he was doing live. I was fascinated by that.
Yeah, Todd is an incredible producer and a multi-instrumentalist and also a visionary. So for him, it was a song about a breakup. The girl dumped him because his hair was too long and her father turned the hose on him when he walked her home. So Basically what he does is he creates a song. But the beauty of that song is she dumped him. But when he decided to write the song, he said, I've got creative license. I can do what I want. In the song, I'm going to dump her. And that's "Hello, It's Me." Those are the first words he imagined he would say if he called her to break up with her.
Well, Mark, it is absolutely a fun, fun book. I really enjoyed reading it. I know that our listeners will enjoy it as well. And thank you for making time to talk to us today.
Dave, it was great being with you. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Our thanks again to Mark Myers for joining us to talk about his new book, Anatomy of 55 More Songs, The Oral History of Top Hits That Changed Rock, Pop, and Soul.
And the newest edition, the 2023 edition, is Anatomy of 55 More Songs, new and expanded edition with 58 songs, also from Grove Press. It's available now at bookstores everywhere and online. My thanks again to Mark Myers and to the gang at Premier Productions who made this possible. Be sure to also check out my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.